as I started to think about this series of lectures, which I have already subverted by entitling mine Modernities instead of Modernisms, as I started to think about this, I came across two passages in two very different books that caught my attention, and I want to quote them because this was sort of a springboard for my thinking and for the talk that will follow. The first passage comes from a book by Marshall Berman that maybe many of you are familiar with called All That Is Solid Melts Into Air, The Experience of Modernity. And this is the passage. To be modern is to live a life of paradox and contradiction. It is to be both revolutionary and conservative. We might even say that to be fully modern is to be anti-modern, since it has been impossible to grasp and embrace the modern world's potentialities without loathing and fighting against some of its most palpable realities. The second quote comes from Carol Gluck, from an essay called The Past in the Present. It's very short. For the once upon a time, there was Edo. Since the definition of the modern required an inverse and an origin, a pre-modern, the Tokugawa was constantly reinvented as tradition. So I hope you'll keep these two quotes in mind as I talk, and also I will bring them back tomorrow when we start the seminar because I think they're worth discussing. So let me turn now to what I would like to present. And I'm going to focus not just on Hokusai's Under the Wave of Kanagawa, which you see here, but more generally on ukiyo-e, pictures of the floating world. Japanese woodcuts, ukiyo-e, occupy a very problematic position in the world history of art. Key sites where conflicting ideas of Japanese national, social, and cultural identity are rehearsed, woodcuts are often read as modern in the context of their own narratives of production and consumption, but traditional in the context of those of their global circulation. Thus, an analysis of a particular print might acknowledge its up-to-dateness with reference to its fashionable subject matter, but whatever its position in its own history, when measured by the standards of European modernity and modernism, this same print is always positioned as traditional, which consigns its value to a confirmation of a static past. A woodcut such as Hiroshige's The Sea of Sata in Suruga Province, which was published in 1858, and Manin's painting of the Battle of the Kearsage and Alabama of 1864, for instance, are never discussed in terms of the contemporaneity, but rather of one being the antecedent of the other. Because ukiyo-e prints are understood to have contributed to the development of European modernism, they have to be construed as past, as prior to the works they inspired, or put differently, as modernity's other. This paradoxical denial of the originality of the original implies that the European interpretation produces meaning, not the Japanese artist. In this way, artistic authority and modernity always resides in Europe. Japanese and Euro-American scholars, collectors, and artists have all participated in the discursive process through which the Edo period print becomes, in Carol Gluck's words, a mirror of modernity. The exponents of Shinhanga, the new print movement that arose in the Taisho era, and later those of Sosakuhanga, the creative print movement, consciously sought to distance themselves from what they perceived to be the outdated cultural and production values of ukiyo-e, even as they traded on the dialectic relationship with them. And on the screen now, you have on the left-hand side an example of Shinhanga, and on the right-hand side of Sosakuhanga, the creative print movement. English language publications often use the word traditional in their titles to capitalize on the nostalgic attractions of images that evoke the world of kabuki actors and geisha. So here's another example of the way prints are pushed backwards in time. Scholarly writings that refer to the loss of authenticity in the rhetoric of degradation when prints incorporate Western elements further contribute to the view that ukiyo-e must somehow be cordoned off from Western modernity. Now, modernity is obviously a very imprecise term with a very vexed history because its interpretation is rooted in Eurocentric paradigms. In the past, it's been used in the context of non-Western cultures only after and because these have had contact with Europe, reducing its manifestations to a single model without discussion of alternative logics, forms, or consequences. While recognizing that no discussion of modernity can ever be completely free of the kind of framework that takes Europe as its measure, recent scholarship has drawn attention to the degree to which modernity is variable and both historically and geographically contingent. Terms such as multiple modernities, alternative modernities, or as the title of this lecture series has it, multi-centered modernisms, which I've changed to multi-centered modernities, all gesture in this direction. Most historians of Japan refer to the period from 1600 to 1868, which is going to be the focus of my talk today, as Kinsei, the early modern period, in recognition of the dynamic mercantile culture that developed in the metropolitan centers of Osaka, Edo, and Kyoto. Also, with reference to the wide circulation of printed materials, the high degree of visual and verbal literacy, among many other factors. But despite this recognition, there's been very little sustained interrogation of modernity with specific reference to ukiyo-e. In fact, as Carol Gluck has pointed out in one of her articles, there's been a lot more writing about ukiyo-e as postmodern than there has about it as modern. How and under what conditions might we talk about the multi-centered modernity of ukiyo-e? In my talk today, I want to use Hokusai's Under the Wave off Kanagawa, originally issued in 1831 as part of his very well-known series, The 36 Views of Mount Fuji, as a point of reference for reflecting on this question from three perspectives. First of all, ukiyo-e as expressions of lived modernity. Secondly, woodblock printing as a cultural technology. And lastly, the adoption of Western perspective as a form of creative translation. And I'm presenting this as a series of propositions to which I'm hoping to elicit, I hope that they will provoke some responses, some thoughts. So let me begin with this idea of ukiyo-e as a thematics of modernity. Modernity, of course, is an analytical category, but it can also be a way of describing lived experience. And it is in this latter sense that I think one can think about ukiyo-e. The term ukiyo-e, by which Japanese woodcuts are commonly known, offers a very useful starting point to think about them as in terms of a thematic of lived modernity within Edo period culture. In contrast to art historical discourse, where ukiyo-e, pictures of the floating world, is a label that connotes tradition, to their Edo period producers and consumers, ukiyo-e connoted fashionable newness. Now, this is implicit in the shift, in the semantic shift of the word ukiyo, which earlier had been used in reference to the Buddhist view of the world as a place of sorrow and suffering. But in the 17th century, it took on a new connotation It became an epithet for the hedonistic, mutable world of the pleasure quarters. So that this in itself, this shift from the religious context to the secular context, is one important one that significant for my argument. But I think even more important in suggesting a new attitude, a new modern attitude that's embedded, encoded in ukiyo-e is the crucial relationship to consumerism, which is made explicit through the linkage of the word ukiyo and e, this conjunction of world of the pleasure quarters and pictures. Because this neologism links the phenomenological experience of the world to the pleasures associated with fungible commodities, pictures whose subjects, styles, and rich colors, and whose very materiality mediated a new awareness of the passage of time and space. Now, how did they do this? Mass printed and widely circulated at modest cost, ukiyo-e offered up the pleasures of sex, theatrical entertainment, fashion, and travel in ways that emphasized the value of being up to date. The frequency with which the word, or the phrase, imayo in the contemporary style, or furyu, stylish, or as seen here, toji of the present day, appear in the titles of depictions of fashionably attired women or kabuki performers clearly speak to this preoccupation with newness, with up-to-dateness, with change, which I take to be a sign emblematic of modernity. Prints also celebrated the rapidly changing urban environment and the growing freedom to move to and from it. Hiroshige's 53 stages of the Tokaido Road, of which you see one on the upper left there, is arguably the most celebrated example of this new culture of mobility. But Hokusai's views of lumber yards or brickyards in his 36 views of Mount Fuji also signal the booming construction that was rapidly transforming the shogunal capital of Edo, and through these prints made viewers and consumers aware of the change of in the city. Another example of this new outlook, which is being made manifest in prints, can be understood by looking at a second coinage that emerged in the Edo period, and that is the term ukiyo-e, which is a cognate of ukiyo-e, which was first used in 1737 to refer to pictures that employed European illusionistic perspective. And this term, I think, alerts us that the modernity of print culture was constituted as much by the alternatively defining pressures from outside of Japan as by those emanating from within. This expanding spatial awareness, this is an example of an ukiyo-e, a floating perspective picture. This expanded awareness is also central to the meaning of Hokusai's Under the Wave of Kanagawa, a work that adapts European perspective to represent the relationship between the great wave in the foreground and the volcano in the distance. But the subject of Hokusai's design, a great wave, is also suggestive of one of the big themes of the modern age, overseas trade and imperialism. Indeed, the ubiquity of great waves in Hokusai's work, as I've argued elsewhere, was part of a new maritime turn in Japanese culture that gave expression to growing anxiety about the permeability of Japan's borders and the threat of invasion by foreign powers. Hokusai's Under the Wave of Kanagawa then speaks directly to the way in which culture and consumption in Japan were discursively shaped by global trade in ways that made the exotic both available and desirable. As Henry Smith has written in the first edition of the Fuji series, the wave that I just showed you and four others, one of which is now on the left, were all printed entirely in an imported aniline blue dye known as Bero or Berlin blue that produced a far more intense and lasting color than natural dyes that had been used before. And in his advertisement for the print series, the publisher Nishimura flagged up this feature, the fact that the prints were going to be made using Bero to promote them. And in so doing, he was capitalizing on the fad for what were known as aizurie, or blueprints, that was in full swing at the time. Berlin blue, as you can see from the print on the left, attracted the eye because of its chromatic impact, But in the 1830s, it was also an index of luxury that materialized the global circulation of goods and capital. Recognizably exotic, Berlin blue connoted prestige goods such as Chinese blue and white porcelain, and through its name, Western goods as well. So this was my first proposition, that we think about the modernity of prints in terms of their thematics, the way they engage with new lifestyles, new consumerism, and new relationships with the world beyond Japan's shores. My second proposition about the modernity of prints has to do with printing technology and thinking about the way in which the prints were produced as a cultural technology. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a few moments. Modernity, wherever it occurs, is associated with the introduction of new technologies that alter the way people view the world and alter social relations in particular. In Europe, the invention of the printing press has been said to mark a great divide, identified with the emergence of a new perceptual field constituted by typographic culture and the primacy of sight. The same might be said of Japan, where the development of large-scale commercial woodblock printing made possible the creation of what Beth Berry has called the Library of Public Information. By this, she refers to printed maps, compendia of famous products from various provinces, encyclopedia, guides to farming, Chinese prose and poetry, etiquette manuals, materia medica, and ukiyo-e. And by way of example, I show a detail of a map and two pages from an album that combined poetry with very naturalistically rendered birds, flora and fauna. Had already a very long history in Japan, but it was only in the Edo period that commercial operations sprang up across the country and that multicolored printing was invented. This technology was both product and producer of a popular print culture marked by a predilection for works with a seamless integration of text and image, works whose circulation drew their consumers into new social and cultural networks. In this sense, I wonder if the term cultural technology, which was coined by Jody Berland to characterize the localized spatio-temporal dimensions of contemporary music or audiovisual media, might be usefully applied to woodblock printing. When in defining her term cultural technology, she writes, "The production of texts cannot be conceived outside the production of diverse and exacting spaces. Much of the time, we're not simply listeners to sound or watchers of images, but occupants of spaces for listening who, by being there, help to produce definite meanings and effects." End quote. Printing technology in Japan similarly engaged both producer and consumer in a mutually constitutive relationship that relied on the producers to make reception part of the productive process. Thinking about printing not simply as a mechanical process, but as a cultural technology, throws light on why mechanical reproduction using woodblocks rather than movable type became the norm in Japan. Now, movable type presses were introduced simultaneously to Japan in the late 16th century from Korea and by the Jesuits. And they were adopted briefly during the early decades of the 17th century, most notably to print no libretti and classical texts such as the Tales of Ise, of which you see a page here. The so-called Sagabon edition was a private publication, however, and it was subsidized by a very wealthy merchant. But because of the very heavy outlay of capital, movable type presses were not taken up for commercial operations. They were largely abandoned there afterwards in favor of woodblock printing using a whole woodblock. I'll explain that in a moment. This abandonment of movable type has been interpreted by some European scholars as evidence of technological lock-in, a kind of misguided rejection of new technology superior to that already established. But what I want to argue is that viewed from the perspective of local social and cultural conditions, woodblock printing made perfect sense and could be understood as an expression of an alternative modernity, a different solution to printing, mass printing. What about printing offered a highly efficient, inexpensive, and standardized system for the mass production of both text and image? Very little capital investment was required to start up a block printing operation. Cherrywood blocks, paper, inks, and payment for skilled carvers, printers, and designers. Woodblock prints and albums could be produced relatively rapidly. And once the blocks were carved, because a single whole block was used for an image or for a whole page of a book, they could be used and reused for an extended period of time if the market demanded it. So this cut down the price of producing a book or print very significantly. And this reprinting could go on decades after the initial publication. For example, the three volumes of Hokusai's 100 Views of Mount Fuji, of which you see a page here, were first issued in 1834 and 1847. But new editions from the same wood blocks were printed in the 1860s, in the 1870s, and even as late as 1943. The logic of using commercial printing using a block for a whole page was informed by the nature of the Sino-Japanese writing system with its large number of Chinese characters and two Japanese syllabaries. Japanese movable type was carved from wood, but forming each character and kana individually and setting it in place for every page of a book was time-consuming and costly. Because of their delicate contours, the carvings, each one of these little characters carved out of wood, was very liable to crack or to break. A large single block carved with an entire page of text or an entire image, by contrast, was not only more durable, but could incorporate text and image on the same page. And even more significantly, I believe, it could incorporate the phonetic notations that helped the reading of difficult Chinese characters that were unfamiliar to many readers, or characters that could be read or pronounced in more than one way. And here is an example of a page, the frontispiece from a book about the hero Kusunoki Masashige. And here you have the title page, and all around it you can see it's printed from a single wood block. You can combine image, then you have the title of each chapter, and then alongside that, in smaller print, you have the mode of pronouncing it, so that people who can't read the characters can read the phonetic syllabary. So my point is that all of this can be done on a single woodblock, printed at one time, and combine multiple forms of apprehension of image and text in a way that was very congenial to the Japanese situation. Woodblock printing offered the further advantage of making it relatively easy to reproduce the extra textual, aesthetic, and representational qualities that were inextricably entwined with the cultural value of the written word through calligraphy. While not all printed texts adopted a recognizable cursive calligraphic style, when they did, their textual authority was distributed between both the author and the calligrapher. This dual authorial identity was integral to their interpretation. The readerly value of the Sagabon edition of the Tales of Issei, which I show again here, for instance, derives from its status as a classical text by Ariwara no Narihira, but also from its typeface, which is modeled on the writing style of Honami Koetsu, one of the most admired calligraphers of his day. This multi-layered convergence of visual and verbal modes of expression was critical to the production and consumption of print culture throughout the Edo period. The value ascribed color was also a key component of printing as cultural technology in Japan. Multicolor printing developed around 1765 and was premised on the invention of a very simple but elegant device known as the kendo that made possible inexpensive and standardized mechanical reproduction of color images of a scale and on a of a quality unmatched anywhere in the world at that time. The kendo is a ridged L-shaped groove carved into the corner of a wood block, and you see it right down here. That helps to align all the color blocks with a key block, thus ensuring perfect registration. Multicolor printing involved a key block for the black outlines, and you see a detail of one on the left, and then an additional wood block for each color. As many as 25 separate blocks might be used for a particularly complex design, with a placement of each one guided by the kendo. Here's an example of a print using many colors. But Hokusai's Under the Wave of Kanagawa is an example of a print that uses relatively limited palette, but nonetheless has a very powerful visual effect. This was printed using 7 separate blocks, 3 for the different shades of blue, which you can see here, 1 for the yellow of the boats, which you can barely make out there. Another, 1 each for the dark gray of the sky behind Fuji and the pale gray on the side of the boats. And then in some impressions, there was another block for a pink tinge on the upper part of the sky. Because of the high degree of standardization and modularity that went into their production, color prints could be sold at a relatively low cost. Impressions of Under the Wave off Kanagawa are estimated to have been issued in the thousands, a number comparable to most commercial prints in the 19th century. Such economies of scale made it possible to sell them at a price roughly equivalent of a bowl of noodles. So these were widely available and available across social strata. The eye-catching palette of colors that are utilized in woodblock prints was integral to their consumer appeal. I've already referred to the special cachet associated with the exotic, saturated tones of Berlin blue in Hokusai's Under the Wave of Kanagawa. But color printing also engaged with status and power relations in a larger sense, because during the Edo period, color was a privilege owned and managed by the elite, both through its cost and through sumptuary laws. Pigments were expensive, and sumptuary laws dictated the colors different classes were entitled to wear. Merchants and artisans, for example, were not permitted to wear silk brocades, and the use of costly red dye, beni, which was extracted from the safflower plant, was also restricted. The term nishikie, brocade prints, which is commonly used aside ukiyo-e, evokes, I think, the connotations of sumptuousness and chromatic scope that was engaged by these prints. While the mass circulation of inexpensive nishikie didn't directly challenge the cultural hegemony of the warrior and aristocratic classes, it destabilized it by offering the public the promise of visual and tactile pleasures that had previously been beyond their reach. Turn now to the last and perhaps most problematic of my 3 angles on the modernity of ukiyo-e, Western perspective as translation. As I've already noted, designers and publishers of woodblock prints were constantly on the lookout for sources of innovation in subject matter and style in order to maintain their market share and attract new consumers. Throughout his career, Hokusai varied his visual repertory by experimenting with the elements of the style of the Kano, the Tosa, and the Rinpa, and the Maruyama schools. Might we also think about his adoption of elements of European design, such as linear perspective, volumetric shading, a horizontal format, and the left-to-right movement that you see here, which was unnatural, uncommon in Japanese design? Might we see these as markers of a fashionably exotic style translated into a dominant local visual language? In discussions of the introduction of illusionistic modes of representation to non-Western countries, It's assumed, following a teleological view of history, that those who adopted them either recognized their superiority as empirical tools or else simply misunderstood them. But in Edo period Japan, where control of the flow of knowledge through the port of Nagasaki meant that cultural exchanges with Europe didn't occur under conditions of perceived political or economic equality, Japanese artists who learned of Western approaches to representation had the power to adopt and adapt what pleased them and reject what didn't. Mastery of perspective was not understood as part of an hegemonic process that threatened to destroy local styles, but one of many alternatives open for creative exploitation. European visual languages contributed to those existing in Japan already to varying degrees. Some artists wholeheartedly embraced the value of imported styles in creating the illusion of reality. But for others, Western perspective was just one tool among many. Hokusai's purposeful and constructive appropriation of Western elements was, to be sure, linked to growing empiricism in Japan. But I would argue that it was more about style and marketing than mastering an objective mode of representing volume and depth. By the 1830s, perspective was a well-domesticated tool that could be adapted to create individual style, and Hokusai himself did so strategically and to advance his own interests. So in Under the Wave of Kanagawa and other prints in the 36 views of Mount Fuji, for instance, this selective, inconsistent, and even subversive use of a Western idiom is dramatically evident in the way he combined it with geometric circles, squares, and triangles that undermine its objective and descriptive function. And you can see it, the way, the configuration of the wave, here the play of geometric form, the triangle of Mount Fuji played against the circle of the barrel. Here you have a variety of geometric forms being repeated, and over here you have various horizontals and verticals playing with Mount Fuji. And I would argue that this is a form of play, a kind of creative adaptation of Western perspective that subverts the empirical purposes to which it was intended to serve. And further undermining the objective and descriptive function of perspective is Hokusai's use of color. The printing of five prints in the series entirely in Berlin blue challenged empiricism by releasing color from the descriptive role it customarily assumed in the Western pictorial tradition. Now, it's obviously very difficult to be sure what any artist's intentions were. But I would argue that Hokusai's use of perspective seems to have been less about representing the reality of the world than about what he saw the potential for novel stylistic development that he saw within Western tools. And he adopted and adapted Western perspective to defamiliarize the familiar in order to add an element of exoticism to the local landscape. So in Under the Wave of Kanagawa, Western perspective was deployed to create a witty and multi-layered visual and verbal punning relationship between the stasis of Mount Fuji and the mutability of waves. And the waves not only mimic the conical form of the sacred volcano, but by becoming seemingly frozen in time and space, they also assume something of Fuji's attribute of immortality. Fuji was said to be immortal. One of the etymologies of the term Fuji is immortality. Furthermore, while Mount Fuji was regarded as Fu-ni, incomparable, and Sangoku no Ichi, standing alone among the three countries of Japan, China, and India, because it was so beautiful and it was so tall, here in the print up in Under the Wave off Kanagawa, the mountain is improbably dwarfed by the scale of a great wave. So what I'm suggesting is all of this is a form of play for Hokusai, creative play. Hokusai seized selectively on instruments of Western empiricism because newness, as we've seen, had a high exchange value within local culture. His use of perspective involved a kind of translation into local codes in keeping with practices appropriate to the time and place. In the process, Hokusai created effects quite different from those of European usage. In this sense, his borrowing was not a direct transplant, but a translation that, in disrupting the proper syntax of the Western system, created a new one. Alternative modernities, I suggest, were thus produced through the work of translation itself. In carrying out his translation, Hokusai was drawing on the principles of mitate, a mediating device central to the creative artistry in print culture. Mitate is a capacious term that is commonly rendered in English as parody, but it might also be understood as translation by analogy. As such, it served to invest the present with the past, the familiar with the unfamiliar, and most pertinently here, the indigenous with the exogenous. It did so by making visible new formal relationships, oftentimes fabricating them without recourse to reality. In so doing, mitate mediated visual, verbal, and material connections in ways that allowed for innovation and change. Now, let me try to explain this using a well-known example. A print by Suzuki Harunobu, a mitate that is based on the classical Chinese theme of the eight views of the Shaanxang River. Now, paintings and poems on this theme had long been in circulation in Japan when, in the early 17th century, a Japanese courtier translated them into a local idiom by poetically relocating the site, and here you see it in one of its early Chinese manifestations, by relocating the site of the eight views from China to the banks of Lake Biwa in Omi province. This gave rise to a series of paintings and prints and poems featuring the eight views of Omi. But Harunobu went one step further by translating the theme into the contemporary urban setting of Edo. Thus, in the print that you see on the left-hand side, he is representing in a modern, domestic, urban guise returning sails at sunset, the view that you see here in its Chinese manifestation. But he has titled it playfully, Returning Sails on the Towel Rack. So the sails of the ship are translated into a towel that is billowing in the wind, drying on the veranda. Viewers of the time delighted in such visual and verbal wit, which simultaneously poked fun at and revalorized Chinese culture and its place within Japan. Such populist modes of reinterpretation underscored the pastness of that which was appropriated, even as they gave expression to Japan's changing relationship to its own past. Through his adaptation of European visual idioms to reinterpret the appearance of a familiar landmark in Under the Wave of Kanagawa, could one argue that Hokusai similarly used this device of mitate, to create a new modernity authorized by Japan? By the same token, this translation device would seem to be serving as a kind of intercultural medium that drew local subjects into new global circuits. The perception of ukiyo-e as traditional has been discursively shaped by modernism. Artists such as Manet and Monet naturalized the idea that only Europeans could creatively translate and produce a modern or modernist style. But as the example of Hokusai's Under the Wave demonstrate, Europe didn't own its visual codes. Like any language, illusionistic perspective offered all of its users creative potential for usages from which multi-sided modernities could emerge. Let me sum up. And what I've tried to suggest in my presentation today is that historically and socially contingent meanings of modernity are inseparable from the local material conditions and technologies and physical forms in which they are manifested. Printing offered a set of conditions, practices, and strategies that fostered alternative forms of modernity, whether construed as lived experience or modernity as an analytical category. But the use of mitate as a translation device reminds us there's a fundamental paradox to modernity. That is that it's not static, but under constant revision. Always looking forward to something new, by definition, modernity is also always creating new pasts. Thank you.